Welcome to the podcast called The Battle for African Agriculture, the space where we challenge dominant narratives and imagine just sustainable futures, especially when it comes to food and farming in Africa. Today we are honored to host Dr. Carlos M. Correa, one of the world's foremost experts on intellectual property, biodiversity, and development policy. Dr. Correa is currently the executive director of the South Center, an intergovernmental organization of developing countries based in Geneva. He is a legal scholar, economist, and a leading voice on the interface between trade, innovation, and human rights. In this episode, we will explore the political economy of seed laws and regulations, the origin of UPOV, and the geopolitical forces shaping seed governance. Welcome, Dr. Correa.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Can you tell us a bit about how you first became involved in intellectual property law and why seed laws in particular became an area of interest for you?
Well, the fact is that I used to work in Argentina in doing an assessment of technology transfer agreements. And of course, one important component of these agreements is intellectual property. It could be trademarks, it could be patents or designs. And therefore, I felt the need to know more about the subject. And then slowly, I moved from technology transfer licensing agreement, which is subject to contractual law, to more in-depth studies of intellectual property.
So were you trained as a lawyer?
I was trained as a lawyer, also as an economist.
Agricultural economist or economist in general?
Well, I studied political economy.
Political economy, yeah. Okay. Many people think of seeds as a natural part of farming, not as an intellectual property right, yeah? Why are seeds now at the center of such intense legal and political issue?
Well, the reason is that since 1961 in particular, there is an international convention for the protection under intellectual property rights of seeds or other propagating materials. And therefore, this has become an issue of great importance for many countries. Of course, developed countries, they have established their own model for the protection under intellectual property of seeds. And the point I'm trying to make very often is that this model may not work in developing countries, in particular in African countries, because the realities are not the same in terms of who is producing the seed, the role of farmers as breeders, and not just as producer of food. And therefore, this has become an important issue because there is a lot of pressure in our countries, including Africa, to adopt the model, which is not probably the most suitable model for these countries.
We'll go deeper into that, Dr. Carlos. Let's go back to the beginning. What is UPOV? And what were the circumstances and interests that led to the creation of UPOV Convention 1961?
Well, UPOV is a Union for the Protection of Plant Varieties. And this was an initiative by commercial breeders in Europe. So they convinced the government, in particular the French government, that there was a need to have a set of rules similar to patents. But they realized that patents could not be applied to plants, because plants already exist. You can improve on them, but you cannot invent the plant variety.
So that's in comparison to other IPRs?
Yeah. So that's comparison to the regular patents that you can get for a mechanical device or pharmaceutical products.
What are the main criteria to patent, for example, a computer or something?
Well, to get a patent, you need to show novelty, inventive step, and industrial applicability. And it was difficult to show novelty in many cases because the varieties already existed.
For the seeds.
It was difficult to prove inventive step because you can only improve a material which does exist. You cannot create from scratch a new seed or plant variety. Therefore, although they made efforts in order to extend patent protection to plant varieties, they found that it was not feasible. And therefore, the commercial breeders in Europe started to think of another way of protecting the seeds. And then they started in the Netherlands and Germany. Uh-huh. They devised this new system, and then they brought this to the attention of the governments, in particular mm-hmm. France. They convened a diplomatic conference mm-hmm. in order to expand national protection mm-hmm. to the international level. Mm-hmm. And therefore, a few European countries actually started EUPOV. So EUPOV is the creation of a few European countries, and a few, initially six countries. Mm-hmm. Only a dozen of European countries signed the first convention, and then they incorporated some other members. But it has not been a very popular convention, I must say, compared mm-hmm. to other conventions on intellectual property.
Why is that?
Well, because at the time this was done, and even at the time when an agreement was adopted in the World Trade Organization mm-hmm. that refers also to the protection of plant varieties or seeds, mm-hmm. most developing countries have not established legislation to protect mm-hmm. seeds or plant varieties. Mm-hmm. So this was completely alien to most developing countries, because it was coming mm-hmm. essentially, as I mentioned, from northern countries, developed countries. And there, this has continued, although this agreement adopted in the context of the World Trade Organization, mm. which requires protection for plant varieties, has led a significant number of developing countries to join EUPOV. Mm-hmm. But not all of them have done so. And therefore, there are still many countries that are looking for their own solutions, mm-hmm. Their own regimes in order to address the issue of seeds, which is very important because one of the main features for intellectual property is mm. that this system grants exclusive rights or legal monopolies. Mm-hmm. And then the major question is, do you actually want seeds and materials to generate food to be monopolized?
Yeah.
Or you want seeds and these materials to be open in order to disseminate, mm. in order to mm. ensure food security? So mm. that's one of the reasons why the fact of monopolizing seeds and plant materials is a subject which is controversial, and many countries are looking for different solutions.
But before 1961, I was asking myself, why France? But anyway, in the USA, there was another mechanism that I think, a protection mechanism. 1930?
Yeah.
What's that? Can you tell us a little bit?
Well, that's correct. In the United States, there was also a lobby made by, in particular, a well-known nursery company to get some kind of protection for plant varieties.
Yeah.
In this case, non-asexually reproduced varieties.
Asexually?
Yeah. Mm. And then they got the Congress of the United States to approve a special law, mm-hmm. which is called the Plants Patent Act 1930, mm-hmm. which is a kind of modified patent for plant varieties, a certain type of plant varieties. Mm-hmm. But then this was the model followed in the United States. In Europe, they did not approve this idea of having a patent, mm-hmm. even if it was modified. Mm-hmm. So they wanted what we call a sui generis system, mm-hmm. a system which is more appropriate in relation to these kind of materials. Mm-hmm. And then you did ask why in France, because there was an important association of breeders
in France
uh-huh. called Asincel. Mm-hmm. That was the main association that pushed for adoption of this kind of legislation and also the EUPOV. Mm.
So how did EUPOV evolve from 1961 to a much more restrictive form of its form in 1991? And who were the main actors pushing for this transformation?
Well, in fact, yes, I think that one of the main actors was the United States that wanted to assimilate as far as possible the protection under EUPOV to patent protection. Mm-hmm. They wanted to strengthen and expand the exclusive rights of the right owner, the breeder. And this was followed by many other members of EUPOV, and then they adopted this EUPOV 1991 Act, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which actually expands the exclusive rights, expands the monopoly, mm-hmm. Including to not only to the propagating material, but to the product of the harvest, which is not in the previous acts of EUPOV. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the objective was to make the system far more similar to patent protection in terms mm-hmm. of the strength of the rights which are conferred. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And certainly this is not again in the line of ensuring that the materials are available for the mm-hmm. farmers, for instance, for saving the seeds, reusing mm-hmm. the seeds, exchanging the seeds with neighbors. So the system went in the other direction.
Yeah.
Again, this amendment to, or this new act for the UPOV was adopted by a small number of countries.
Mm-hmm. developed countries, 1991,
mm-hmm. small number of countries, just mm-hmm. 20 countries on the whole, mm-hmm. including South Africa, that at that time was, mm-hmm. As we know, subject to a different rule. Mm-hmm. But then it has no representation at all from developing countries, and much less from farmers. It was thus mm-hmm. done on behalf of the breeders, commercial breeders, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. pursuing mm-hmm. their interests. Mm-hmm. But farmers were not part mm-hmm. of the discussion. And as we know, farmers are breeders, mm-hmm. but they were not part of any discussion regarding this system. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. What role have European governments, corporations, and international donors have played in pressuring developing countries to adapt to POV 91?
Well, I think many European institutions, eventually donors, they intend to convince mm-hmm. that model is suitable to other countries. In fact, I had a meeting several years ago with people from the European Commission. We talked about this issue, mm-hmm. and they told me, well, you know, UPOV is working for Europe, mm-hmm. then it will work also for Africa, Asia, and Latin America. There is no reason why it should not.
Yeah. And then, but is UPOV working for Europe?
Yeah. But then, my point was, well, you know, the reality is so different, because in these countries, farmers' varieties are crucial, very important.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the level of development of the commercial seed industry is completely different. Mm. But then, in their belief, it is what is good for them is good for the others.
Yeah.
Of course, this is good for the breeders, European breeders.
Yeah.
That through getting this system extended in developing countries, they ensure export markets.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's good for them, but this is not necessarily the case for breeders and farmers in our countries.
But in Europe also, I think I've met so many farmers and organizations who stand for the rights of farmers, who are not happy with UPOV 1991. So is it beneficial to European farmers?
Well, not necessarily, but they have been out of the discussion, as I mentioned before, because these systems are actually promoted by the commercial breeders, and therefore they have no opportunity to participate in these kind of discussions. Mm. And this, I'm not surprised that this is the case also for farmers in Europe. Because this legislation essentially looking at serving the interests of commercial breeders.
Yeah.
So this is the point. And therefore, it is natural that farmers, including in Europe, they may not feel comfortable.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you so much. Very interesting. How do free trade agreements and economic partnership agreements in EPAs contribute to this pressure?
Well,
can you give us examples?
Well, the fact is that, in particular, the European Union and the United States, when they negotiate free trade agreements, as you know, they include chapters on intellectual property. Mm-hmm. And one of the requirements in those chapters has often been, or in all cases be, for the partner country to join UPOV.
Yeah.
So negotiations with developing countries to establish free trade agreements, for instance, the United States with Latin American countries, this has been a clear demand from the United States, saying we are going to sign this agreement only if you agree to join UPOV, in this case, UPOV 1991. So this has been the position, and this is why also UPOV has expanded into many developing countries. Mm-hmm. It was not because of free choice by these countries. It was because of, was part of the deal in order to get a free trade agreement in which these countries were interested in. I must say, however, that there has been an important exception when the European Union negotiated a free trade agreement with Mercosur. Mercosur. These are the countries, Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, Uruguay, and also Bolivia has joined. Mm. Then when this negotiation took place, these countries opposed strongly to an obligation to join EUPOV 1991 because they are members of EUPOV, but EUPOV 1978, which is not so stringent in terms of the rights which are conferred. Mm. And then that was an important exception because the position by Mercosur negotiators led to an outcome in which the European Union was not able to impose that obligation. So that's a good precedent. Yeah. It will be good now that the European Union has negotiated with India also an agreement, free trade agreement. A good precedent for India not to follow that approach.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Interesting. In many African countries, over 80% of the seats come from formal seat system. What happens to the systems when EUPOV 91 is implemented?
Well, the fact is that EUPOV 1991 fully ignores these systems because the idea is that only varieties which comply with certain requirements, including uniformity and stability, can be protected. And farmers' variety may not comply with these requirements, in particular uniformity or stability, because by the very essence, these farmers' varieties evolve. They adapt constantly to climate change, soil conditions, so on and so forth. And this is very important, this very important value of these local varieties, because they become more resilient. And of course, they can also provide a reasonable yield.
Sorry, but productivity. Can you explain? It has to be NDUS, yeah?
Yes, that's correct.
New, distinct, uniform, and stable.
That's correct.
Can you explain what each of these words stand for? And yesterday I've heard you that, especially the two, uniformity and stability, are dangerous. You know, the changing climate, food crisis that we are having, compromising the culture of the local people, which is related to the diversity. So can you explain that, please?
Well, novelty means that the variety should not be available in the market within a certain period. So it should be novel in, to some extent or relatively.
Novelty is new.
It's new.
Yeah.
This thing, it means that there should be at least one feature that will allow to differentiate this variety from previous existing varieties. It may be just a feature, so you don't need to have, of course you cannot develop, as I mentioned, a new variety from scratch. You can only improve or make changes on existing varieties.
Can you give example?
Yeah. So maybe you change the color in the flower, or you change the size of some part of the plants. So there may be some phenotype changes that will be shown in order to indicate that it's not exactly as the previous one.
Phenotype meaning the visible part of
the visible parts of it. Yeah. So it will be enough to have a phenotype change in order to get this this requirement to be complied with. Then uniformity means that when you plant the seed, what you get are similar. So you get the same height, you have the same particularities, the same features for all the plants. And this is very visible when you look at a field which is planted with uniform varieties. It's very interesting how they look. And stability means that if you replant, you will get the same kind of variety.
So in subsequent generations.
In subsequent generations. So at one point, of course, this will deteriorate depending on the crop.
Obviously,
But during a number of cultivations, you will get exactly the same. But then this uniformity and stability means that the farmers' varieties, which may not be such, are out of the system. Because these varieties are not conceived or developed in order to be uniform in the first place or to remain stable. They are conceived to change, or there is no intent for them to remain stable. And this is very important in order to preserve and also to enrich the genetic material.
The diversity.
Because diversity, because uniformity means that you are just using one particular genetic material, And then you keep this going without changes over time. With the land races, on the contrary, you promote genetic changes. And this enrich, of course, agriculture and allows agriculture to become more resilient and actually serve the interests of local populations.
Yeah, basically, it's monoculture crops do come from this uniformity and stability. And monocultures are vulnerable to so many changes, you know?
Yeah.
So uniformity and stability in the changing climate and changing conditions is not a preferred characteristics of a crop.
No, it's the preference in terms of commercialization.
Yeah.
Because then the consumer or the big purchases, for instance, the big supermarkets, they can get whatever they are expecting to get because it is uniform, and then they will always get the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's not the ideal in terms of a sustainable agriculture and in terms of a resilient agriculture. That's not the ideal model.
Yeah. Is there any empirical evidence that adapting OPOV 1991 leads to greater innovation or productivity in agriculture, especially in the global south?
No, really, there isn't. There is, in fact, more evidence that the previous act of UPOV, the 1978, which is more flexible, has actually led to a significant increase in innovation. Mm. The study was done many years ago for some countries, including Argentina, China, which follow 1978. And it has shown how the number of plant varieties registered increased, and also the number of breeders increased. Mm. And recently, some statistics that were shown by Aprivis indicate that at least 60% of the new varieties are created in countries that follow UPOV 1978, not UPOV 1991. So I would not support or endorse the statement that there is evidence that 1991 is better in terms of promoting innovation.
I mean, related to that, what is the experience of countries like those in OAP, in Western Africa, which adapted UPOV 1991 under pressure? Has a promised seed sector transformation happened there?
Well, as far as I know, this did not happen. I think there are some statistics showing that the number of new varieties that have been created in these countries is very low. So I'd like to see some more studies on the subject. But as far as I know, the information I got, there is no evidence at all that OAP members have actually gained in any manner from joining UPOV 1991. I think that was a premature kind of a decision made without a deep assessment of what the consequences of the system would be and whether there could be other options that would be more suitable for these countries.
I think OAP, under OAP, there are 17 countries.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, right. 17 countries. And actually, I heard yesterday Mohamed Koulibaly saying that some of these varieties, actually, which were under UPOV 1991, they were never tested to their full capacity. No, it was not sure whether these new varieties are actually new, whether they are uniform. So the whole thing was a sham. Huh?
Yeah, because in order to implement the system, you also need some capacity in the countries to make the testing or to make the assessment of what is being submitted. Now, there are different methods in order to register a new plant variety, but in any case, you need the capacity to assess the application and to determine whether it is new and it conforms to the requirements. And then capacity building is needed in order to be able to apply the system.
Thank you. Many countries, including India, Ethiopia, Thailand, have opted for sui generis instead of UPOV. What lessons can we learn from these alternatives?
Well, we need more studies, but some of the information which is available, I presented some today, shows that, in particular in the case of India, which adopted the sui generis law in 2001, there has been a significant use by farmers of the system. So this law applies to new varieties in the sense that, similar to the UPOV model, but it also applies to what are called extant varieties, including farmers varieties. And interestingly, there is a very large number of applications and also registration of farmer varieties, which shows that the law has actually reflected the scenario which exists in developing countries like India, the fact that farmers are main producers of seeds and not just commercial entities.
Yeah.
And therefore, I think it's a good experience. It would be very interesting to do more studies for Thailand and other countries that also have sui generis regimes and have also the authorities are actually applying these the criteria that have been established in the laws. But I would say that there is very good reason to think that this is the approach to be followed.
I've seen, I think the figure, if I remember correctly, the farmer's application was over 10,000.
Yeah.
While it's from industry, private, combined, it's 2,000-something.
That's correct, yeah. In the case of India, a farmer's application actually exceeds maybe four or five times application by the private sector or by companies, showing that farmers are aware of the system and they are willing also to get the kind of protection which is afforded under the system.
So how can countries design seed laws that protect both biodiversity and farmers' rights while still enabling innovation?
Well, I think these, the examples that we already have in this country show that this is possible. There is a significant policy space. There are many studies, including some a tool that I presented today that was developed in order to facilitate the establishment of sui generis law. It is really the outcome of a lot of thinking, which are the best ways of protecting farmer varieties and varieties which are of common knowledge, including new varieties. And therefore, there is really a lot of many analyses have been made, and recommendations are there. It's just for each country to adopt what this country thinks may be suitable.
Yeah.
But of course, in the case of Africa now, there is a major challenge, and it's the fact that that annex will be developed on the protocol on the free trade agreement on plant variety protection. And the challenge is to develop an annex which is actually what the African continent needs, and not just a replication of the model which may be suitable for different contexts. So I think there's a major challenge for Africa, for the African continent, to find its own solution. I think we give a major example to other developing countries if they are able to do so.
Yeah.
But I think there's a major today is a major opportunity to show that there are alternatives. But also governments and civil society and farmers need to be very active in order to ensure that these alternative approaches are reflected in the new legislation.
Thank you very much. You have emphasized the importance of aligning national laws with instruments like International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture and UNDROP. Why is this alignment crucial?
Well, it's crucial because a plant variety protection system should not just aim at providing rights to the breeders, whether these are farmers or companies or individuals. But the main objective should be to achieve food security, to ensure that there is a sustainable agriculture. So the International Treaty for Plant Genetic Resources, Food and Agriculture is essentially about sustainable agriculture and the conservation and exchange of plant materials. And therefore, this is important to have as an element when you think about this legislation, is not the objective to provide a kind of legal protection. It's to ensure that you are going to, through this legislation, to promote sustainable agriculture, and that you are going to ensure to the extent possible that these regulations will be suitable also to ensure food security.
What are the dangers of creating legal systems that prioritize breeders over farmers, especially in the context of climate change and food insecurity?
Well, that's the point. There should be no preference given to breeders over the farmers, because farmers are also breeders, in particular in a region like Africa. And as we are talking now with climate change, the preservation, the conservation, and the further development of local varieties becomes a major tool for these countries to fight climate change. So this constant adaptation is essential. So therefore, I think it's the time to understand that we need to look at this complete picture. Yeah. And then to develop a system that addresses not only the rights of the creator of new varieties, but also the right to food and the right to sustainable agriculture, which is essential for the African continent and other regions as well.
Yeah. I have two concluding questions for you. If you could give one piece of advice for African governments reviewing their seed laws today, what would that be?
Well, design a model that is adapted to your needs. You should not just import or incorporate a model that may work elsewhere.
Yeah.
So the elements are there in order to design the laws that actually reflect the interests of the continent. And then the advice is to assess very carefully what these rules will be, what the impact could be, and to find the solutions that are adequate, appropriate, and suitable for the continent as it is today.
As a final shot, Dr. Carlos, what gives you hope in the fight for just, inclusive, and biodiversity-rich seed systems?
Yeah. Well, I think this is a fight that should be a common fight for all.
Yeah, everybody,
Not only of civil society, of a small group of people. I think all mankind should be fighting for the same. The future of the planet, in fact, depends on a good understanding of what is happening today, how you can correct what is going on. And then understanding that we need to protect nature, to protect biodiversity, to use it in a sustainable manner. And otherwise, we will not leave the future generations a planet where they can live and where they can eat and survive. So I think it's a crucial fight.
What gives you hope? Do you see any fight, and have you seen anything in this meeting?
Well, I think there is a hope that this will go further. As you know, in particular, young people is now coming very strongly. So they are understanding that their future also depends very much on this. So I hope that this will go further. Despite some moments, as now we are living with a position of some countries that think that climate change does not exist.
But
I think this will not last for a long time.
Yeah.
I think the truth is there, the evidence is there. I think the only response is just to take the measures that will protect the future of the planet and the future generations.
Thank you very much, Dr. Carlos. Really appreciate it.
No, thank you.